Good morning. On behalf of Michael Green, the staff and members of Green's List, may I welcome each of you to this morning's breakfast briefing. This breakfast is the fifth and final breakfast briefing in a series of such briefings which have been devoted entirely to discussions of aspects of practicality concerning the criminal law. The breakfast briefings have proved over the last 5 weeks in the criminal law field to be popular, enjoyable, and most importantly, informative. So we hope that all of you today will gain some knowledge from our speakers. Today's topic, as you're aware, is criminal law in the Magistrates' Court. The format for this morning is that we have two speakers, at the conclusion of which, if time permits, we will permit some questions. So if any of you have got burning questions about criminal law in the Magistrates' Court, I'm sure our speakers will try and assist. So hopefully we'll have some time at the end to take some questions. Our intention is to conclude before 9 a.m. because we're very conscious that all of you have busy practices to attend. Our first speaker is Joanne Piggott. Jo was admitted to practice in 1987. Thereafter, for the next 8 years, she practiced as a solicitor in private practice in insurance litigation principally, before joining the Office of Public Prosecutions. She was then appointed to the position of Assistant Legal Advisor to the Chief Commissioner of Police through the Victorian Government Solicitor's Office. She remained in that position for some 6 years before transferring to the Legislation Department of the Department of Justice. Whilst in that position, she was responsible for criminal matters, censorship and bills introducing stalking, extension of intervention orders, victim impact statements. Some of us will have our own ideas on some of that legislation, body samples and contamination of products. However, in 1995, 15 years ago, she came to the bar, and over the past 15 years has developed a broad practice in criminal law, including magistrates' courts and in family law and related matters. Jo will be known to most of you as an able and experienced advocate. Today she is to address us in respect to summary contests in the magistrates' court, with some reference to the Criminal Procedure Act 2009, which came into force on the 1st of January of this year, 2010, and which affects our practice of summary matters in the Magistrates Court. So if we could welcome Jo Piggott to the lectern, thank you.
Thank you very much, Ed. The Magistrates Court is an area which I think I always see as the grassroots, the very busy, popular field, which I think many people perhaps shy away from admitting that they've got quite a healthy practice in. The higher courts, County and Supreme and Court of Appeal, perhaps is not one that is the bread and butter of many barristers and solicitors. What I thought I'd do this morning, because I'm not sure how much people know or whether they've attended any of the other criminal breakfast briefings in this area, is to give a bit of a rundown on how, from charge to contest, what the procedure is, And I have actually some flowcharts which I discovered last night, which I can have emailed out to you later on today, which are not included in the handout. And I do apologise for that, so don't worry too much about the procedural side. The other aspect is, once you reach the contested hearing, just a few perhaps practical tips on how to manage it, a few little hiccups that I've discovered in some of the matters that I've run for those who actually intend to do their own appearance work or even if they brief out. As far as the getting from the charge to the contest, the Criminal Procedure Act, or the intention of it, was perhaps to streamline the process and in some cases bring it a little bit more in line with either the committal procedures or trial procedures. There are two main ways in which charges get started. One is the more simple matters, which are by way of a notice to appear, and the others are matters by summons, warrant or arrest cases, which commence with a preliminary brief. The difference being is that when a notice to appear is used, there's a preliminary brief served within 7 days and a filing of a charge sheet, and then it moves on to the summary case conference. That is the mandatory procedure. When a preliminary brief is served, then there may be a case conference. So I've set out the procedures in the notes. The case conference is a procedure which probably is a formalisation of what actually occurred when you were down at court, perhaps on a contest mention date, which is talking to the prosecution about the summary, making any amendments, negotiating charges. For example, if there are matters with what I call a hamburger, where there's everything from assault to cause serious injury, negotiating the withdrawal of those charges or some of the alternatives. That occurs prior to the contest mention. And in practical terms, especially if you've been down at Heidelberg Court, downstairs is a room with a bit of paper stuck up on the door with the summary case conference, and it's an opportunity, queue up, you talk to the prosecutor about those matters. There can be also requests for additional material. Important when you attend that to make, I would say, a clear record or notes of what was promised or undertaken by the prosecution and what charges. The contents of that conference is not to be disclosed in court without both parties agreeing to the material being disclosed. It is an opportunity to perhaps sort out the real issues, and then at that stage an opportunity to perhaps consult with your client to determine whether there'll be a plea or what course of action your client is intending to take. I've set out on pages 1 and 2 the procedure for the charge sheet, for the failing to file a charge sheet, and the basic timelines. Okay. Now, one of the next major parts of the procedure is the prosecution disclosure. The Criminal Procedure Act, I think, prides itself on almost forcing prosecution disclosure in a much more formal way rather than perhaps the ad hoc way that we've been used to matters proceeding. Its purpose is to promote basic disclosure at an early stage in summary proceedings, and I refer to sections 35 to 38, which refers to the preliminary brief. The preliminary brief is to contain the charge sheet, the notice about recommending and about legal representation, but more importantly, a sworn summary. And this is how it differs from the previous, summary of the case. Sworn summary by the informant, which includes the alleged offence, the accused statements, possible witnesses, exhibits, and also a notice of any refused material. The procedure is intended to bring disclosure both in summary procedures and committal to be pretty much the same. Section 41 deals with the ongoing obligation to disclose material. One could be somewhat cynical, and so that really depends on the diligence of both the solicitor and the prosecution. The witness details and some of the material which may not be disclosed are on similar grounds as subpoenas and witness summons. A notice, if there are matters which are not to be disclosed, is to be given to the accused. If the accused requests material, the prosecution is to comply with the request for the material or serve a notice of grounds of refusal. And the third main element is the full brief, which in, to all intents and purposes is similar to the hand-up brief. Now, the case conferences, as I said, can be heard even if an accused has legal representation but his legal representative is not at court. And one may be familiar with the times where legal aid actually has been engaged. The accused has been sent to court to probably on the basis of saving costs to apply for the next date or whatever. The court will permit that case conference to go ahead even though that their lawyer is not there that day. It's really to keep the matter moving along. Now, contested hearings. There are two main differences, and I'm referring to page 5, if you want to turn to that page now. There, unlike the previous procedures, there is an opportunity with leave of the court, and in 4.1 should be leave of the court for an opening or a closing address. One would presume that if the prosecution's given leave to give an opening, then so the defence would be able to. That is intended to relate to perhaps more complex matters or where there's multiple charges over a series of time, and they're designed to bring it more in line with the trial procedure. Then again, the leave's required for a closing address, which is a statement of the basic facts. The prosecution also has the leave of a right to apply. That may simplify matters, and as we're all quite aware, it depends on who you appear for, the nature of the matter before the court. In many cases, like a minor assault, probably wouldn't be necessary. And there's always a bit of a danger of going beyond the actual facts before the court. Differs again from addressing the court on a point of law, which has always really been permitted. On page 6, I go into the procedure and summary hearings in the absence of an accused. There can be a course of action, 5.1, where the court may direct the summons be served personally if it has not already been, a warrant of arrest, or hear and determine the charge in the absence of the accused, or again, adjourn the proceedings. If the full brief or preliminary brief has been served, the material contained in that may be admissible together with further evidence. So the matter can proceed not only on the material which the accused was aware of, but any additional material that the prosecution has got before it, perhaps obtained in days leading up to that non-appearance. However, one of the important things is that, refer to 5.3, the court's limited in what it can do. So if the matter is of a more serious nature, it's more likely that the magistrate will adjourn off the proceedings, or and or issue a warrant of a for arrest. On the following page, on page 7, there is a right to apply for a rehearing. And the various grounds at 8.6 onward, 8.8, section 88 onwards deal with the grounds on which that rehearing can occur. One of the more interesting aspects or more important aspects is in relation to summary offences, where there's also a whole stack of perhaps indictable offences which are going up to the county or Supreme Court. The court must transfer all of those summary offences to the higher court. Previously they were just adjourned or sine die, so you got a bit of a mess sometimes when the accused was going for trial and had these summary offences sort of floating around in the ether, and sometimes they end up cropping up at the end of or just going off and being dealt with later. So the accused attends for one lot of cases and then has to deal with the summary offences. Once that happens, DPP has conducted the summary charges, and these must be, of course, matters ancillary to the indictable matters. For example, some minor charges arising out of perhaps caused serious injury or aggravated burglary, as long as they're usually in the same connection of time frame, incidents, etc., then they will travel up with the other offences. Once there is a finding of guilt or the accused pleads guilty, the court can deal with them at the same time. The court also has discretion to move them back to the magistrate's court. And then again, that depends on the circumstances and the severity of the summary offences. On page 8, I've gone through the indictable offences which can be heard summarily. There is, as you're probably all aware, a jurisdictional limit of the magistrate's court, which is found in sections 113, 112 capital A and 113D of the Sentencing Act, with a cap on 2 years in custodial and a 500 penalty units for a natural person and 2,500 for a corporate accused. If anyone's interested, there's the Kate Brookings comments in Hansford against His Honour Judge Neesham, 1995, 2VR 233 at page 236 to 237. I can email that citation for you if you wish to comment on that. And it's saying, whilst these charges can be heard summarily, there is the limit. And of course, the magistrate has the power to determine whether they're appropriate and may ask for the prosecution to read out the summary, consider the circumstances and deal with them there and then, or transfer them along to the higher court. The accused must consent, which is fairly important matter given the penalty ranges. Section 30 indicates that either party may apply for the court to deal with the matters summarily at any time before the court determines whether to commit for trial. Now, this could happen certainly during the lead up to the committal. It can happen before the end of the committal hearing. We all know that sometimes the client's quite brave until perhaps some of the more damning evidence comes out at committal and perhaps has a change of heart. It's still not too late as long as the committal hearing has not been completed. It can be offered by the magistrate, and many common sense magistrates may view that it's easier and more practical and in everyone's interest to have it dealt with there and then at the magistrate's court, or either party, either the prosecution, which I think might be quite unlikely, or the accused representative can
ask for the matter to be dealt with there and then. One other important change is the Children's Court, where all matters are heard summarily. The limitation for period for commencing proceedings is reduced to 6 months from the date of the alleged offence. Hence, you may get a call from prosecutors panicking, knowing that they're going to be out of time and will have to have an extension of time. Some witnesses, often in motor vehicle matters, there's a bit of a runaround at the last minute on those. Magistrates Court, Children's Court, they can hold joint committals for adults and child co-accused. So that's another interesting point. I can see that I'm quickly running out of time, so I'll move on to just a couple of practical points. Magistrates Court, often in my experience, the accused is quite passionate about the fact they didn't do it, it wasn't them, or the police have got it all wrong, and they really do want to stand up there and tell the magistrate their version of things. Probably because it's a lot less daunting than a jury trial, probably because a lot of other factors had not had the experience in the run-of-the-mill appearances before court. On page 10, I've run through a few little points and included some character evidence material because I think that's something that you should warn your client about. Often they say, oh, I've got 10 witnesses that can all come along to court and say what a good bloke I am. There are some risks in taking that course of action and leading evidence of good character. One point to remind the client is just because they don't have any prior convictions is not particularly as persuasive that they are people of good character. Evidence of bad character usually inadmissible on the basis that it's unfairly prejudicial, and it can be used, however, to negate the evidence of good character. That tends to, in my view, cloud the issues, and it might be just a lot simpler to take your client aside, explain in fairly basic terms the risks if they go down that path, and just run it on the facts. Now, practical tips, which may or may be stating the obvious to a lot of you, a chronology. In preparing your matter for trial or for a summary contest, I've always found that doing a chronology is absolutely invaluable. It, for one thing, gives you a bit of a time frame which you can cross-reference to, well, what is the other evidence you've got? Is it witness B, who was there at the same time? Was it the fact that a phone call was made at the same time? And it really is quite a good way of sorting out perhaps more complex briefs. And I can vouch that it actually, although it may take time, saves time and clarifies a lot of the issues. It tends to identify the strengths and weaknesses in a case. And shows you really, well, we've got a big gap between, say, 10:30 and 11, what happened. The other thing is, in the Magistrates Court, I feel that often people are rushed, briefs are given late, clients come in last minute, day before major point in the hearing process. But with Google Maps and all the streetscapes, etc., maps, plans and photographs are invaluable, and frequently, and I had a case recently where the police photos were of the wrong side of the road and put a totally different complexion on the buildings. So it was a car dealership and it had someone on some side, one on the other. Police had taken the wrong side. I wouldn't have known until the maps had come out and we actually saw it. So it does pay off. Gives the magistrate much more of an idea. And the old saying, picture paints 1,000 words. Witnesses for the defence, Number one, never rely on the client telling you he's got all these witnesses or come along. If they're not subpoenaed, often they don't turn up with the excuses like his boss wouldn't let him have the day off, work, the children are sick, etc., etc. If they're important, subpoena does no harm. Once they get there, the irritation perhaps of being subpoenaed will have worn off. And I think people are very loath to issue subpoenas, especially when it's meant to be the best mate or someone like that turning up. The number of times where the so-called strong case ended up with just one witness, the accused. Another point, transcripts of the record of the interview. In cases where a victim or accused has actually not sworn up very well at all to their statement, there's the trap that I fall into, I do admit, on one occasion at least, where there's been agreement, magistrate says, well, record of interview going in, yep, that's fine, but the evidence that's just been given, in fact, didn't relate or but anywhere near what was put to the accused. Therefore, what do you do? You either ask for the matter to be stood down and spend some time editing all the irrelevant material or unsworn up to material out of the record of interview, or perhaps even put it to the court that they should look at that material as a prior inconsistent statement of the victim. And unfortunately, as you know, magistrates have often not got a lot of time. You all of a sudden, case before you folds and you're on, and in the running of things. But it's something just to keep in mind. I've had a couple of cases where the victims of domestic violence, very detailed statements, warning bells should have started ringing when their English actually wasn't particularly good, and it was a very, very detailed statement. Witness gets into the box and is absolutely pathetic. Yes, he hit me, and that was about all she says. And there's page after page after page of all the material being put to the accused and his responses, which really should go out. If you feel that it might be more at your advantage to have it in and say that it was a prior inconsistent statement, then that's a call you can make at the time. The election of the accused comes obviously after the prosecution case. One thing I would say, have in the back of your mind that you always may be lucky and there might be no case submission. Good idea is just to have your elements of the offences jotted down and tick them off. Magistrate will probably be doing the same. And give it a go. Make a no-case submission if you feel that it's worth it. You never know what the magistrate may have made it. Sometimes they'll interrupt you and say, don't worry, Miss Piggott, I've already formed that view. But I think it's something we tend to perhaps get sometimes a little intimidated by some of the prosecutors. Or intimidated by some of the magistrates. Another issue which I think is probably very dear to practitioners' hearts, and also I understand is mandatory if you're doing legal aid matters, is application for costs. Try and have that at least a rough ballpark figure with you and a basis for it. Magistrates may think it's reasonable, but in matters where there have been numerous conferences, numerous adjournments, court appearances, if you can just have outlined why you arrived at that figure, you're much more likely to get it. There's a couple I've had in recently where the magistrate said, oh, I think that's a bit outrageous, your client's been over service, but when we actually went down and said, look, there was this date and set it out, well, we got quite a bit more than we'd actually asked for. There's nothing worse than when you've perhaps surprised yourself and the charges have been dismissed. Application for costs. Police want to do it there and then. They're usually not happy and they usually won't really adjourn it off. Magistrate often will adjourn it off for costs to be discussed, but my experience, far better to just have some some reasonable figure and how it's broken down, available for presentation there and then. The other thing is also plea material. Warn your client that might not be lucky, might not be successful, and get them to bring their plea material there and then on the day. If you don't need it, fantastic. Nothing worse than standing up and fumbling around trying to have a conference in 5 minutes after they've run the case and perhaps not shown themselves in true glory. Then again, if there are perhaps some medical issues, psychiatric issues, by all means make the application to have, say, 3 or 4 weeks adjournment for the plea material to be presented. The other thing is warn your client if there is any likelihood of a custodial sentence. And I always feel that it's best to tell them what the maximum is, so that then when they perhaps get a lot less than that, they don't quiver in their boots or make some outrageous comment in the body of the court. Advise them that there can be appealed bail, and have those brief details, which usually you can chat with the prosecutor either beforehand or across the bar table about whether the bail will be opposed. Always best, I think, to warn the client of the worst scenario. Get them to do a bit of the running around. After all, it's their case. And a lot of them, I hate to say, perhaps have got more time on their hands than many of the people in this room. And the other thing is, phone call, if there are any witnesses, quick call to see whether this person actually is a witness, rather than just some great mate who's going to come along and say the fellow's a good bloke and wouldn't have done it. My view is that actually running magistrates' court summary matters is probably a lot harder in many ways than the trial process, because you're pressed for time. The magistrates, judge and jury, often there's not the cost to prepare properly and client comes in late, but the essence is in the detail. And I've been told it's out of time. So good luck, everyone. Thank you.
Sorry to do that, but we are working to a timetable. Could I just very briefly commend to you the detail in Joe's paper and urge upon those of you who have not read or do not have a copy of the Criminal Procedure Act to get a copy, to read it, because it does set out very clearly the procedure in our courts. It's very helpful. It's actually an act that is helpful to those of us that act for defendants or accused in part, particularly in, as Joe said, the discovery or disclosure processes. And it changes the terminology, as a solicitor pointed out to me the other day, some ways. So you need to become familiar with the terminology and the procedures as set out in this new act. So it's an important act that regulates the way in which we act in our courts.